This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervey's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervey. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. And Alexa, play 790 KABC. I am Alan Gervey, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here in studio, actually, to be the managing partner of your life. And Carrie Kasem is here with me. She is videotaping. What the heck are you doing, Carrie?
You know, it's social media. You always ask, hey, did you tape? Did you take any pictures? And I have. Look, I'm on air. Hi, guys. Yeah, social
media. Are you live?
No, I'm not going to do this live, just in case we don't look good. You know, we can fix it up afterward. I'm kidding.
Well, we've got a great show today, Carrie. You know that because you're wearing your braids. I never see you in braids.
Because my hair is
Pippi Longstocking.
I am Pippi Longstocking. No, my hair is so filthy and so dirty. I had to do this.
I don't need to know that.
Yeah.
So later in the show, really interesting. Talk about filthy and dirty.
Mm.
We have a topic that you really don't want to miss. We have Daniel Hatcher with us, who's with the University of Baltimore School of Law, professor of law, and he's going to talk about his book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. So many interesting stories. He was featured in the Netflix documentary on Gabriel Fernandez, the trials of Gabriel Fernandez, a really unfortunate, sad situation. You have to hear about that. And joining Daniel on the phone, we are going to have Diane Worley, who is just a wonderful attorney. She's the executive director of the California Applicant Attorneys Association and former director of policy implementation at the California Applicant Attorneys Association. And she's going to talk about the experience that injured workers have had with a company called Maximus that you're going to hear about from Daniel Hatcher, and how there's been so many problems trying to get medical treatment for injured workers because of this company, Maximum. That's my view. That's an editorial, by the way. Carrie, you're nodding your head.
Well, you told me about it, and it sounds horrific. It sounds absolutely horrific, especially from all the money that they get and what they're putting out. It doesn't work. It's not gelling in my head.
And Professor Hatcher is going to tell us a lot of examples that is in his book, The Poverty Industry, about how a private company can be taking money away from the people who most need it. And when we talk about that, we talk about what's going on right now where so many people need funds because of the pandemic. And it really bleeds into so many industries, including personal injury.
Right.
And we're really fortunate now to welcome to Gervey's Law Kathy MacArthur. She's the principal at the MacArthur Law Firm in Macon, Georgia, and she's one of the top 10 personal injury attorneys in Georgia, as stated by Super Lawyers. She's board certified in civil trial advocacy by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, and she's a member of the Multi-Million Dollar Advocates Forum. Kathy, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thanks a lot. I'm happy to be here on the show tonight.
Well, you're not really here. You're there.
This is true.
And there's quite a difference being in California than being in Georgia right now. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what it's like in Georgia versus what we're dealing with here in California? Because, you know, we've heard so much about the governor in Georgia and Governor Kemp, of course, and the shelter in place order that probably lasted the shortest period of time in the whole country.
Yeah, our governor really distinguished himself. First, he distinguished himself by saying that he was going to put the shelter-in-place order, probably the latest in the country. He was going to put it in place because he had just heard that coronavirus could be spread when people didn't have symptoms. And I think the rest of the world and the country had known it for at least a month, if not longer. Governor Kemp said he just found out that day, so he went ahead and locked us down for about a little over 2 weeks. And then following that fiasco, he came back on and has gone ahead, and he has opened several industries first. And this makes sense. He he did take the lockdown off non-essential surgeries so that elective surgery could go forward and medical offices could go forward. But along with that, he went ahead and opened tattoo parlors, massage parlors, nail salons, barbershops, and hair salons, and bowling alleys.
Wait a second. So those are the essential services in Georgia, those tattoo parlors and massage parlors?
When it's somebody's business and they're going to feed their kids, they're going to say to them, that's essential.
Well, yeah. I tell you what, we like to get our hair done and our nails done.
That's right. That's right, Kathy. That's right. I see both sides of it. I do. And I look at Sweden who didn't close down. I look at the 8 states, in the 50. I mean, like the 8 states have very few cases. And Sweden, same thing. So I go, well, all right, that worked for them. Maybe it can work for Georgia, but you're there. You're living it.
Yeah.
So
the following Monday after Friday, which was this past Monday, he opened in-restaurant dining. With social distancing and no more than 10 in a group or whatever, but we're basically open here in Georgia, and I understand the competing arguments about the economy and people's livelihoods. And he opened the same day movie theaters also. So I'm just not really sure about our I'm not sure that there's anything that is not open now. And then on the 30th of April, he did not extend our shelter-in-place order at all, except for people 65 and older who are compromised with their health. So the only people sheltering in place are those people, and the rest of us are free to go about our business and do our thing and do social distancing and pretty well just business as usual, except for whatever individuals find to be reasonable, rational, and common sense at this point. So you see most people with masks on when they're out in public. Most restaurants did not open. They will be opening soon, but with a lot of different measures.
How has that impacted your work as a trial attorney, as a personal injury attorney doing medical malpractice and personal injury? How does this affect your work, and are you concerned at all about the loosening of the restrictions?
Well, I'm concerned about the loosening of restrictions because of the fact that we haven't even in Georgia hit our peak yet. But as far as how it's affected my practice, we are, by the way, law has been considered an essential service. So we've been able to come in and be at the office. But we have a judicial emergency order in place, which I'm sure you must as well. So our judicial emergency is in place until May 13th, and maybe extended. So we can't, anybody that doesn't want to do a deposition doesn't have to do it. We have no hearings. We have no trials, any trials that were, supposed to go forward.
You don't even have them by telephone or by Zoom or anything like that?
You're not required to do that. And some hearings have gone forward, but most depositions are not going forward. I have two malpractice cases scheduled to go to trial, one in June and one in August. The one in June is already gone. The court said they didn't feel like they could do it. The one that's in Macon coming up, the judge took the position unless we would agree to give up a 12-person jury or a 6-person jury so he could socially distance, that we could not go forward with the one that is in August. So the defense wouldn't agree to a 6-person jury. They wanted a 12-person jury, and in fact, they just wanted the delay, which is what being a defense lawyer in medical malpractice mostly is about, is delay,
yes.
Delay, delay.
Yeah. Well, so, it's not only medical malpractice, and, we're seeing here, all the delays, but we are getting a lot of pressure to do our court appearances by telephone. They have an 800 number. It's working fairly well, and we're hopefully going to be able to do some trials as well. And it's just surprising to hear that there's so many, so few restrictions now in Georgia, yet the legal system is not working as well as it sounds like it's working here in California.
No, we're just we're basically frozen in place pretty much on everything. I don't know of any workers' comp hearings going forward. Right. I don't know, and I can't imagine a trial being done remotely like that. But we'll just have to see how it works. I think the one thing that happened was in Albany, Georgia, which has been horribly hit. And it's a small town. It's smaller than Macon, Georgia. So it's a small place, but it's like had over 1,000 deaths in just in that area. And it was, it became such a hot spot because there were two funerals that went forward and there were a bunch of people at each funeral. And apparently somebody came, of course they came from New York, but anyway, came to the funeral and they had it and they spread it throughout. And then following the two funerals, they've traced it that they had a jury selection pool of about 250 people at the courthouse in Albany, Georgia. And, a number like, maybe a third of the people who were at that jury selection were infected, and the probate court judge died. And so we had such a negative situation in terms of gatherings of people leading to just incredible numbers of people being infected that I don't think that we really don't have much hope of any jury trial, I don't think, for the remainder of this year. Until it gets to be where they feel like they can get people together in a group of a couple hundred people without having to, I don't know how we could socially distance them. So we're, you know, it's like we're being on front page news as far as opening everything, but to the extent, from the legal standpoint, it's not meaning a whole lot. I mean, some lawyers are trying to do some Zoom depositions and you know, things like that. And that, it works so well. I don't know. How have y'all found it to be there?
Yeah, it's been, it has been absolutely great. I've had a number of Zoom depositions, doctor depositions, as well as plaintiff depositions, working perfectly well. Even with interpreters, it works well. But it sounds so frustrating. I'm listening to you, Kathy, and I'm thinking, what do you do with your time? And then I hear about what you have done with your time, co-founding a fund in Macon called the Macon 30-Day Fund, helping small businesses in Macon with providing up to $3,000 forgivable loans and grants to help keep them afloat. Pretty incredible work you're doing.
That's wonderful, Kathy. I wanted to tell you that,
well,
too.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate y'all bringing that up because that's been something that's been extremely rewarding. We have over 200 applications for the grant. And, you know, Macon is a town of like 350,000 or so. And it's not a huge town, but we have over 200 applications of small businesses. And, the, you know, in order to be eligible, they have to have at least 3 employees and no more than 30. So we're talking, you know, pretty small businesses. And they are desperate for cash. Most of them, I don't know of one that has actually received any federal assistance. And, of course, they've been shut down for quite a while in terms of being able to do anything. So we started the Macon 30-Day Fund, and it was patterned after a similar fund for the state of Virginia called the Virginia 30-Day Fund. And it's getting started all over the country, and there may even be one starting now in Los Angeles, but it's where individuals from the community get together and try to raise money for the sake of providing grants to your small businesses so that not every business is going to end up, you know, being Lowe's or Home Depot or chain everything. The small businesses, which would be restaurants. I mean, it's been all kinds of small businesses. I mean, dance studios, photography studios, just you name it. We've had applications from them, landscaping companies, nurseries.
It's amazing.
You know,
it really
lots
is.
Of restaurants.
And congratulations for doing that, because it must be, like I said, really difficult to proceed with your cases. You're in the middle of a lot of them, and they're being delayed, especially, and I appreciate you saying by the defendants, because I agree with you. I think it's unfair that everyone should try their best to move forward in any way they can. We only have a minute left. Tell us, Kathy, what you see in your crystal ball with your line of law, personal injury and medical malpractice. What do you see moving forward? And I know it's a tough one. I mean, the crystal balls haven't been great for any of us, but what do you see in Georgia moving forward?
Well, as far as my field is concerned, I'm very concerned about, and I believe that the healthcare workers on the front line should be considered heroes, and there's no doubt about that. I am concerned about going forward with trials anytime real soon and suing doctors and nurses for what would be open and shut malpractice that we're going to be affected, or plaintiffs will be, or injured parties by people's perception of all healthcare individuals as selfless and, you know, that they should not be held responsible. They've been granted immunity, and I agree with this, for any of their healthcare actions that have to do with coronavirus, because no one knows how to treat it. So there is immunity during this time. So I'm real concerned about that as far as our area of practice going forward. On the other hand, I think that we're all going to come through this, and we're going to get through it. Everybody is going to have learned a lot of different things. We're going to do bigger and better for all of us, and hopefully at some point we will be less divided as a country as a result of this. And
I'm very, very with you on that.
Yeah. Interesting perspective on the medical malpractice cases, because I think a lot of people haven't considered that. I happen to agree that people still have their individual rights, whether it's related to COVID-19 or not. And, you know, people like you are championing those rights for victims. And we appreciate, Kathy MacArthur, the time that you've spent with us here on Gervie's Law. It's the MacArthur Law Firm in Macon, Georgia. And good luck with your, I don't even know what to say. It's obviously not shelter in place, but
I think they're going to be just fine, just like Sweden, just like the 8 states that didn't. I think you guys will be fine. That's my hope. Yes.
I hope so, too.
I hope our death rate isn't Sweden's, because I think theirs is 12%.
And, yeah, I think the CDC came out with a whole bunch of different numbers a couple days ago. Yeah. You should check it out. Yeah.
I appreciate the well wishes, and I certainly hope you're right.
All right, take good care.
Bye.
Right, gotta take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Gervie's Law. Still thinking about what can go wrong? Instead, let's get excited about what can go right on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Wrong again.
Yeah, Art knows that I'm a big Green Day fan. Yeah, I just like listening to Green Day. Me and Joe Armstrong had some great performances. He's got one with his two kids.
Backing me up.
I think we're alone now. Check that out. But I'm not here to promote Green Day, my favorite band. Thanks for playing that, Art. So now we're going to change the subject just a bit, and we're going to welcome to the show Daniel Hatcher, who's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the Saul Ewing Civil Advocacy Clinic professor. He's a professor of poverty law, child welfare policy and practice, child support, healthcare law. He used to work for the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau. And he wrote a book called The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. And it got some really great reviews. It's amazing how just through a book, people's eyes are opened up. Here's a couple of the reviews. This is an important book that deserves wide readership. While a widespread myth persists of poor folks who rip off the government by taking advantage of various welfare programs, the author reveals that those taking advantage are those ripping off welfare in a wholesale fashion are those within government themselves, along with an entire industry of private consulting firms with whom agencies contract to siphon funds from the federal welfare systems. Another review. This book is an amazing eye-opener. I'm not sure I'll be able to sleep tonight, as I can't stop mulling over the terrible state practices Hatcher reveals in this book. States, counties, and private companies working together to draw federal dollars for vulnerable populations and then use the majority of the funds on filling general fund coffers or private pockets. So disturbing. And that's the case here in California with the workers' compensation system. I want to welcome also to the program Diane Worley, who is the executive director of the California Applicant Attorneys Association. They represent attorneys who represent injured workers, and she's represent both injured workers and employers. She's a certified workers' comp specialist. Daniel Hatcher,
welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be on the show.
And Diane Worley, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you so much for having me.
Daniel, we want to start with you. Tell us about how you got interested in this. And I must say also, we're going to talk a little bit about the next Netflix documentary, The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez, really disturbing piece on Netflix, which, Daniel, you were part of. But before we get to that, tell us the genesis of how you uncovered these very, very disturbing issues that are really plaguing our society.
Well, thank you for the question. It's been a long path for me, and it really started, you mentioned the show about Gabriel. It started back to my early work at Legal Aid when I was representing children in the foster care system in Baltimore. And there I was a frontline staff attorney, had a huge caseload. I remember my first day in court, I represented probably about 16 children just one afternoon. It was overwhelming in terms of the circumstances that I encountered, the hardship that the kids were going through while they're in struggling homes, the hardship they encountered when they're in foster care, often abused again and again once they entered the system. And what became even more concerning to me is when I started to see problems with the system itself, right? And the system is all of us, you know, the attorneys involved in it, the courts, the agencies, really everybody involved in the system, where there were problematic structural concerns that were causing harm to the children. One of the most striking examples that I came across that then led to other research and ultimately led to my book was how foster care agencies who exist to protect the best interests of, or really the most vulnerable citizens in our country, the foster care agencies themselves were taking resources from children in their care. They would seek to maximize the number of children determined disabled, look for children who have dead parents, and then take their Social Security benefits. Even for those children who might have had parents who died in the military, they'll take their Veterans Assistance benefits.
Wait, who's taking those benefits?
It's the state or the county agencies, and it depends on the state, right? And that's complex in terms of some of my research and trying to narrow this down to where it's happening, either at the state level, at the county level, sometimes at the city level. But it's generally the state agencies that are taking the benefits. They're working with private contractors. They often hire private revenue contractors to help with the process.
So does like this money Maryland, that they're taking go to the child at all in any point? Is this to help with his care? Is this to help with, you know, when maybe when the child turns 18, he gets those funds back?
Unfortunately not. No. Wow. And these are monies that are supposed to belong to the children, whether they're for the child's disabling conditions, if it's SSI benefits, or survivor benefits if they have a parent who died, which is much like life insurance, right, or Veterans Assistance benefits. Right. So the states take those monies from the children, and it doesn't even help the foster care agency because it just goes into the general state coffers rather than helping the children as intended.
Hmm. Wow.
This is happening pretty much across the country. California, it's in the millions that are happening. California has worked with contractors, both Maximus and another group called the Public Consultant Group, to do work on these types of issues.
I was going to say, I want to talk about Maximus because you bring that up. That's a company that comes up more and more. The name comes up not only in the work that you've done, but if you Google it, you will see all these seemingly good intended benefits that Maximus seems to be really squashing and really ruining and taking away. Tell us how Maximus comes into play with what you're talking about.
Well, you know, Maximus is a huge organization, company. They're publicly traded, and they have contracts probably in most, if not all, states and outside of the U.S. as well. In terms of my research, I've encountered Maximus in multiple ways. They are one of the contractors that states have often used to help maximize children's resources, children's Social Security benefits that the states then take from the children. They've also had contracts regarding Medicaid issues that I've written about, both with, in terms of working with hospitals and nursing homes, how states will use healthcare providers as a way to maximize federal Medicaid funds, and then too often those funds are diverted to general state coffers rather than actually used for health care for the vulnerable populations as intended. I've also encountered activists in child support operations when I was a young legal aid lawyer as well. I did some work in the family law courts, including child support, and Maximus had the contract to run the entire Baltimore City child support office. So it's a company that provides both consulting work and also direct operations, right? And that varies state by state. Maximus has contracts with the federal government, with states, with counties. Almost everywhere you look, Maximus or a company like Maximus is involved.
What's changing? I did watch the documentary. It was heartbreaking. I mean, just, it was so hard to watch. And you can't believe what this child went through. And how many times did people call about this poor kid and nothing was done? How many times?
Daniel, was Maximus involved with really the Gabriel Fernandez case?
Go ahead, say it again.
I'm sorry?
Was Maximus involved in the case that Carrie's referring to, Gabriel Fernandez?
Maximus was apparently, no, I didn't do direct work in that case, you know, so my...
But you did comment on the Netflix documentary, you commented.
Right. So my understanding of Maximus' involvement in the documentary had to do with the workforce work regarding some of the... and that part of the problem that Gabriel encountered with all these different system players that aren't communicating well with each other, both from the child welfare side and the workforce development side. And my understanding is that Maximus had a contract with the county to do some of the workforce development, and that office encountered the family at that time.
And they lied and lied and lied. How many times? I mean, it was unbelievable trying to get the truth out of people who were working. And it was very hard to watch that.
But wasn't it the case that they wouldn't work overtime?
Yeah. And one of them, that's all right. Let it go.
Because Maximus wouldn't pay them,
that's right,
the workers to work. And they actually discouraged it because they were trying to save money.
That's right.
Not caring that someone who is being abused, child abuse, doesn't stop at 5 p.m. or at 4 p.m. That can go at any time. But Maximus was collecting their money to administer these benefits, yet weren't willing to be there for these kids, especially Gabriel Fernandez, who was beaten to death.
Right. And the woman who could have done something about it decided to tell her workers and her employees not to do anything because she's trying to protect Maximus. She's trying to protect her own job. I mean, it's horrific.
Yeah. There were apparently overtime concerns there. And Maximus has had allegations of overtime problems in other states. I know from news stories. But when you watch that show, too, I think it's just so striking how really every part of the system was failing, Gabriel. And it's overwhelming in a way to try to unpack that and figure out where all those interconnections are and how they should have worked to his benefit. And instead, they worked against him. And I think that goes a lot to what I've written about is this idea that mission matters, right? You know, like, and if you have a government agency that exists to protect the best interests of children, they need to be pure to that mission. So I actually, like in all this and the work that I've looked at, I'm concerned a lot with the interaction with these private companies that they're part of the poverty industry that I write about. I'm more concerned with the government actors because the government actors have that mission of promoting the public good. The private actors, Maximus, exist to make a profit for themselves and for their shareholders.
Well, we got to take.
I would rather more of this work be done by government employees for that very reason. I think mission matters.
That makes a lot of sense.
When the work is done by government employees, it's done better.
Daniel, we got to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to talk to Diane Worley, and I'm sure she's going to tell us about the same. You know, the points that you're making are really relevant to California and the workers' compensation system and the denial of treatment that Maximus apparently is in charge of through independent medical review. And we're going to hear some statistics from Diane Worley after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. I'm Alan Gervie, and I'm here with Carrie Kasem.
That's me.
And she commented during the break that we are really in a dark, dark room right now.
What are you talking about?
you know, where the topic we're talking about is very frustrating and depressing.
That, yes, but we're not in a dark room. We're fully
that
lit.
That was a metaphor,
fully
Carrie.
Lit.
I know we've got lots of light
fully
here.
Fully lit.
Lots of light, Carrie. You got to follow.
Yeah.
So I know that Diane Worley, who's the executive director of the California Applicants Attorneys Associations, who are attorneys who represent injured workers, and I am one of them, she has been listening to Daniel Hatcher, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, talking about the poverty industry, the book that he wrote, and how foster children, low-income fathers, families, child abuse, all of these very difficult subjects are really not being served very well by the government funding that is supposed to be helping out. And I know in listening, Diane, you're thinking about the company Maximus, an independent medical review in the workers' compensation system in California, and how it has impacted injured workers and some more victims in our society. Tell us a little bit about the independent medical review system and how it has been, in my view, and these are my words, a failure.
Thank you, Alan. I wish I had some uplifting news to give, but unfortunately, you know, the story that I have to tell just follows what Daniel describes. Maximus was already in the state of California before we had independent medical review in California. It was already dealing with Medi-Cal and other disability insurance programs. So when we had a big workers' comp reform in late 2012, they turned to Maximus before a contract was even reached to take care of running what is a government program but is independent medical review of treatment decisions for injured workers. From the get-go, the problems with Maximus mirror, you know, exactly what, you know, Daniel describes. You know, I mean, the overall problem is when you have a for-profit company running a government or state-run program designed to help the most vulnerable people, you know, you're going to end up having issues because their reason to be is to, you know, cut expenses, in this case for insurance companies and employers in the state of California, and to make a profit for themselves. In California, it's pretty unlikely you're going to get your treatment after you've gone through the IMR system with Maximus. What happens is, you know, every time a doctor prescribes something for an injured worker, it has to go either be approved, and if it's not approved, it goes through utilization review that the insurance company sends it to. And when that treatment gets denied, there then is an opportunity for the injured worker, often through their attorney, to appeal that to Maximus. And less than 10% of the time, Maximus overturns that denial. So I guess you can look at it as 90% of the time, you're not going to get that treatment. You're out of luck. You know, Maximus isn't there to serve the injured worker and to help them. They're more of a vehicle for the insurance company to cut expenses. And in fact, that's what their website says. I'm just going to read it. It says that they promote independent medical review as a control on the cost that employers would be charged in their workers' comp premiums.
What about Diane, about how much money they're making? Because it seems very strange when you're talking about medical treatment that is prescribed by treating doctors and they're mostly on medical provider networks. So the employers or the insurance companies are choosing those doctors and then they are actually denying, for the most part, the treatment that those doctors that have been chosen to treat the injured worker on the medical provider networks recommendations. So tell us a little bit about how these doctors who review through Maximus, and I think on their website, don't they
tell you that you can have a great career making like $50 an hour by denying treatment, spending about 10 or 15 minutes with each particular case. Actually, they don't say that, but the fact is,
I was looking at the website, but I couldn't find it.
No, it's not on the website. But I mean, there's a lot of money that Maximus, and this is something that Daniel was alluding to, for the number of these independent medical reviews, and they're making about what, $500 or $400 per review, paying a doctor maybe $50 and profiting the rest?
That's right. Well, that's why there is an incentive to deny treatment. The more denials there are, the more they're going to make. So, you know, every year since IMR has been in the state of California, the price for each independent medical review has gone down. So for 2020, it's only $345 for each appeal to Maximus. Back in 2013, I think it was twice that. So it's gone down each year. However, even with this lower cost in 2020, I figured it out. Based on the data that's available, Maximus issues 184,733 determinations a year. This is based on the last 7 years of data, which has been pretty steady. And if you take the lowest price, which is $345, that means that they're making $63,732,885 a year just on this one program. You know, they are publicly traded on the stock exchange, and I looked back, and the only thing I could see that was up published public data was in 2018, and they had revenue of over $2 billion in 2018. And then the flip side of it is that the savings that insurance companies and employers have had as the result of these treatment cuts in the state of California is $2.4 billion.
Wow. And Maximus is claiming that there's $1 billion in taxpayer savings per year because of IMR, yet it's not taxpayers who are saving the money. They're actually footing the bill, because the injured workers who can't get treatment through the system, through the insurance companies who really should be providing the treatment, are relegated to going to public or private insurance or to the hospitals.
That's right. That's right. No, I saw that too, and it's the exact opposite, actually. Because if an injured worker can't get that treatment through workers' comp, they're going to have to get it either through their private group health, through their union trust fund, through Medi-Cal, Medicare, depending upon what their circumstances are. If they're impoverished, they're going to go to the county clinic. The cities are going to pay for it. The counties are, and they do already. So that's the system we've got. You know, it mirrors everything that is happening in other programs, such as child welfare, Medicaid, Medicare, and other programs, disability programs. And the last thing, I want to say is that the first year Maximus was in California, I got this phone call from a documentary maker in the UK. He called me to say he wanted to find out what was happening with Maximus in the U.S., but particularly in California, because Maximus came into the U.K. and started to run their disability insurance program and started cutting people off, right and left, and it just became another kind of short road to poverty in the country, and it was a disaster, basically. So there is a documentary. I don't know if he ever finished it, if it ever, ever got on the air in the UK, but it was specifically directed at what Maximus was doing in that.
Diane, we have to take a break. Before we do, Daniel, I'm sure you're sitting here listening. You have no reason to disagree with anything that Diane has said, do you?
I wish I could, but unfortunately, I agree with everything she said. It's a deep concern. I think it's another really unfortunate, stark example of when an inherently governmental function should be carried out by the government, right, and not by a private actor. And we see what the results are.
Do you know anything about the documentary in Great Britain that Diane is referring to?
I don't specifically, but I have heard of several concerns in other countries dealing with potential contracts with Maximus and other. Maximus is just one company that's doing this sort of work. There are multiple others who are also trying to get in on the poverty industry.
We really need to make a documentary about this. I don't know where Michael Moore is these days. Ken Koch is sitting beside me. He makes documentaries.
You
maybe you should consider this. We got to take a break, Carrie. We're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
We are talking to Daniel Hatcher, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and Diane Worley, the executive director of the California African Attorneys Association. And before the break, Diane was telling us things that are very hard to believe. I know I live it in the system, so I understand what's going on. Daniel, how do companies like Maximus get away with this? You've talked about the poverty triangle, for instance, where you have the federal funds going to states and companies like Maximus and the states paying Maximus, Maximus lobbying states, federal governments. Why isn't anything being done? Why are people sitting back and allowing this to happen when the victims, the people who really need the assistance, aren't getting it?
Well, it's a great question, and I hope that shows like yours will help increase awareness so that more people do know, and that there can be gradual good change, right? But it's a long process. I think in part because the practices are very complex and they're somewhat hidden, you know, in the actual process and the large government bureaucracies working with these industries, that most people are unaware of these practices. And then even when they are exposed, it can be really hard for many people to understand the intricacies of what's occurring. I think like right now, if we look at our nursing homes across the country, our nursing homes, even before the pandemic, right, were in horrible condition on average. I mean, it's almost criminal, the state of nursing home care in this country. And some of our wealthier states, right, have really low numbers and grades, if you will, in terms of their quality of care for a nursing home. California gets a C grade. It looks like one of the studies I look at. Maryland, the state where I live, gets a D grade, right? Texas gets an F. Michigan gets an F. So there's already concern before the pandemic. And now over 10,000, right, nursing home residents have died, you know, who are virtually trapped in these nursing homes. These nursing home residents are used in multiple different revenue maximization schemes that I've written about, right, where states, counties will use them in ways to move money around, claim more federal Medicaid dollars that are supposed to help the nursing homes, supposed to help provide nursing home care to those vulnerable residents, but instead the counties and the states get that money and divert it to general state coffers instead.
You know, Daniel, I was going to bring this up in the very beginning. It sounds so much like what's going on with, you know, the children, the CPS and Maximus. It sounds like what's happening with the elderly. And a lot of people don't understand what's going on and how the elderly are being used as human ATM machines, being passed around.
I agree.
Yeah, whether it's a for-profit guardian, whether it's, you know, they're in a subpar facility, everybody's making money off this person and they're not being taken care of. They're over-medicated. Yeah, they're drugged. They don't get fair trials. The judges, I mean, it's like, are you human? Are you hearing what's happening to this person? They have a family who wants to take care of them, but you have an outside guardian that's never met anybody, and they're just making money.
Everybody's making money off of them, but they're getting horrible care. I can agree, and it should be criminal. You know, like these are the individuals who built this country and who raised all of the children who are now adults, right? And this is how we treat them as a society, and it's really disgusting. And I hope we do better.
Yeah,
of course we need to do better. And Diane, when we talk about people who through no fault of their own get injured on the job, isn't it the same thing that Daniel and Carrie are talking about, that we're turning our backs, and when we're allowing Maximus, independent medical review, utilization review to deny the treatment, we're just creating a bigger problem that exists with injuries than what existed before they put this into effect in 2012?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, injured workers are a vulnerable population, and many of them are out of work and they're, you know, just one paycheck away from being homeless. And then they have to deal with that, you know, not being able to get the medical care that they need so that they can recover and go back to work. And it's just an endless cycle. And, you know, so they're suffering in the same way as you know, some of the other populations in the state that aren't being treated right.
We have a couple of minutes. We don't want to end on such a downer. Can first, let's start with Diane, and then we'll get to Daniel. Tell us about what we can do moving forward to try to help these vulnerable people and the population that are underserved.
Well, you know, in my work, you know, as you know, Alan, I think it's just an uphill battle to educate, you know, labor groups, the legislators, to understand how the reforms that took place in 2012 are actually costing more money in the long run, hidden costs, you know, despite the savings to the carriers from not having to pay for medical treatment. Cost for disability that's extended, injuries become more chronic and serious because of that. And in some cases, you know, the most horrific result would be death. So it's just a matter of education over and over again with people that aren't aware that this is going on.
Daniel?
Well, it did take a lot of time to get on to every issue, but it is very possible to improve these practices. And this is the start by people being aware, right? So you have to start with awareness. You know, I think Einstein had a quote that if he had an hour to fix any problem, he'd spend the first 55 minutes trying to understand the problem before he tries to fix it, right? There is now legislation that will hopefully be reintroduced. I worked with a congressman out of Illinois, Danny Davis, who introduced legislation to protect foster children's resources. My hope is that will be reintroduced. Also, right now in California, residents of California could call the governor and say, stop taking resources for children. You know, nursing homes, California should not be a C grade. California should lead the nation in terms of the quality of care for our older Americans, right? And there's no reason
Agreed.
That can't happen.
That is the truth. We're going to have to wrap up, but I want to just tell people, it's a must read, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel Hatcher, professor of law at University of Baltimore School of Law, is the author, and you will really learn a lot, eye-opening experience reading it. And for you, Diane, you know, people have to get to their legislators. They have to stand up and start saying, we're enough of giving Maximus and companies like them this money to exploit and really injure the injured more than what we're seeing now.
Hear, hear.
Diane?
Absolutely. I agree. Thank you.
Thank
for
you.
Saying that.
Thank
you for being with us, Diane
thank,
and Daniel.
Thank you both.
Stay safe, both of you.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for Gervie's Law. Carrie, stay safe.
You too. See you next week.
Ken Koch and Alki David, stay safe. See you next week.
This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.